Hello, this is Mark Knights talking about print culture in the 18th century. And we might start by thinking, why is that an important subject? Firstly, I think it relates to a theme that we've been pursuing over the module of national identity, and print played an important role in fostering national identity. It helped to create a national political culture, but it also helped to create what Benedict Anderson calls an imagined community. It is also important in thinking about changing attitudes to religion, to morality, and to piety. Many churchmen feared that the church was blasting away and firing a cannon of immoral, profane, blasphemous, and irreligious material, which was undermining conventional ideas. And print also plays an important role in popular politics and reform movements, as we were seeing last term. And it's also an important vehicle for the dissemination of learning and scientific ideas associated with the Enlightenment that we'll have a look at in more detail next week. It is, of course, also a commodity in its own right and part of the consumer revolution that we have looked at in previous weeks. It's also an area that a good deal of literary critics are interested in terms of reading practices. Who and how is this material being read? And I suppose print also ties in with current preoccupations about censorship and regulation, whether they're censors, whether censorship is necessary for satirical cartoons against Islam, or whether the internet needs regulation. These are all questions which have concerned us in the recent past. Certainly, contemporaries thought that there was something new about the way in which press was creating public opinion and using and mobilizing public opinion. And there's a quote on the accompanying PowerPoint from an MP in 1738 who said that he thought that there was a new supreme authority that had never been known before, the government of the press. And in order to think about that process by which the press became more and more influential and the invoker and reflector, manipulator of public opinion, we might think about the ideas of the German sociologist Jürgen Habermas, who developed a notion of the public sphere, a sphere in which private individuals came together, mainly from the bourgeois classes, to discuss initially literary and artistic works, but very rapidly political and economic ones, creating a sort of forum, either of a physical nature, located in the coffee houses and the clubs and the polite societies of the 18th century, or a more metaphorical one in the print, a forum which facilitated and encouraged the public debate of issues of society and of the state, a sort of intermediary forum between society and the state that then became instrumental in shaping the policies of the state. The question obviously occurs early on, how much print was there in the 18th century? And one way of answering this is to look at the number of titles produced per decade, and there's a graph on the PowerPoint showing the very large increase in the output of the press, measured in that way, from the mid-18th century onwards, though we might also note in passing that earlier peaks of output had coincided with ends to censorship by the government. And it's that question of censorship that is important to consider here, because pre-publication censorship lapsed in 1695. Thereafter, the government didn't control what was in print before it was actually printed. It could only control it after it was printed. That's not to say that regulation of the press simply ceases, however, and there are many other ways in which censorship, or regulation perhaps is a better way of putting it, continued beyond 1695. One way was to tax the press, as the 1712 Stamp Act showed, but another was to rely on treason or libel prosecutions, and particularly seditious libel was a very useful tool. General warrants could also be issued by the government, at least until the Wilkite affair, allowing the government to make general searches for the presses, amongst the presses that they thought might be producing seditious material. There are also sort of niche areas of print that were perhaps more regulated than others. Parliamentary reporting, for example, is one of those that didn't really become free until 1771. But for most of the 18th century, aside from the Wilkite affair, and perhaps even because of the Wilkite affair, there is a growing sense that freedom of print is an essential liberty of the Englishman or the Briton. That situation rather changes at the end of our period, in the wake of the French Revolution and the outpourings of political radicalism and popular politics in the early 19th century. So in 1795 and then again in 1819, there are acts passed, again listed on the PowerPoint, which curtail the freedom of speech, and there are details there as well about the number of prosecutions. An alternative strategy, of course, for the government is not to censor or to regulate the press, but to use the press to produce its own propaganda, its own version of affairs. And I suppose we might point to the work of Robert Harley, who became Prime Minister in 1710, and his recruitment of Daniel Defoe and Jonathan Swift as propagandists for his point of view, or to Walpole, who spent very significant amounts of money either buying over writers or indeed their journals. Literacy rates, of course, are important here when we're thinking about who precisely has access to this, and there's a graph showing the declining rate of illiteracy, though also one which notes the disparity between male and female illiteracy. But basically, illiteracy was declining, and Britons were remarkably literate, particularly urban Britons, particularly compared to their continental counterparts. And they might gain access to print through the clubs and societies which were proliferating in the 18th century, through libraries, through the postal system, through booksellers, through book auctions, through the coffee houses, through reading material collectively on street corners, which brings us to the question of how was this material being read, and was it different to the way in which we read material now? And you could argue that collaborative, shared reading was perhaps far more extensive than is the case today. People would sit around reading and discussing the print in a sociable manner, or sometimes not so sociable manner, but in a collective manner at least. And we might also point to a sort of shift from an early modern intensive reading practice to a more extensive reading as print output increased. It was impossible to read everything that was printed, and therefore one had to read in a slightly different way. One also could, in the 18th century, interact with the producers of print, letters to editors and letters which provoked responses from the periodicals became increasingly common, And advertisements were another means by which individuals could, if you like, personalise and interact with their periodicals. Other genres which are becoming important are handbills in this moment, where print could be produced very cheaply, these are often important in electioneering. But the Englishman's delight in news is a very common feature of the period, and the rise of the newspaper press is a very striking feature of the 18th century. It's the birth of daily newspapers, evening newspapers, Sunday newspapers. Consumption of newspapers goes up very considerably. Print runs are showing consistently that consumption is also increasing. But it's also not just a London-centred newspaper market, it's also a provincial newspaper press by the end of the 18th century. Whereas there were no provincial newspapers in 1700, by 1820 Britain had over 300 regional and provincial newspapers. Many of them, of course, copying material from London, but others increasingly developing their own regional perspective. And finally, because we've used a lot of graphic satire, graphic prints in our lectures, we thought it might be useful just to pause and think about the production of that visual type of print. And we've seen how Hogarth used and exploited the print media for social, moral, religious and political satires, how he came into conflict with Wilkes. But this type of printed satire material really takes off in the 1760s, 1770s. There are about three a week being produced in the 1780s, 7 to 10 by the early 19th century. Who's buying them? Well, more often than not, a more elite clientele, as is depicted by the various prints which show people looking at print shops windows and attending caricature exhibitions. But also worth thinking a little bit about how the print material could be used to undercut some of the conventions. I talked in a previous lecture about politeness and the notions of politeness, which were increasingly fashionable. But a lot of the print caricatures that we've been looking at are far from polite. They're rather impolite. Indeed, they revel in their impoliteness. So looking at the printed press, whether it's of a visual nature or of a textual nature, can lead us to question how far some of the sort of cultural conventions were actually followed, or how far print was actually used to undermine the conventions that other sections of the print press are trying to propagate. So print was an extraordinarily ambiguous and manipulative and ambiguous genre that could be used to buttress authority, could be used to undermine it, and could be used to try and construct ideals as well as to laugh and to destroy them. And it's that variety of uses that is perhaps particularly striking. Just a note, I suppose, that by the 19th century, the type of print that we've been looking at is largely being displaced by comic journals with text interspersed with cartoons, so the sort of standalone print that we've been looking at. So print is also a constantly evolving form, which is always adapting to new markets, to new technologies, and to new demands.